Hey, welcome, welcome,
welcome,
welcome to the Marshaverse. This is a place in the rest of the universe where I come to make shit make sense.
From the entertainment capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada, it's Midnight in the Marshaverse, starring Marsha Warfield and her two sons, Stephen Roberts and Skills Hudson, as the problem child.
Good morning. Welcome once again to Midnight in the Marshaverse, where I am Marsha and it is midnight. Anyway, this is a magic time. This has been known throughout history as a spiritual time where the spirits are more accessible and easier to beseech and solicit. Also, it's known as the witching hour, where witches come into their power, which is really just a way of saying feminine power. But feminine power is terrifying to people who are in charge and whose only claim to being in charge is that they're men. So when women show any sort of power that they can't understand, that's something that has to be suppressed. And so women are all too often not aware of just how powerful we are, exactly what our powers are, and exactly how to use them. So I created the Marshaverse, where I use mine here. I created a matriarchy that serves anybody who wants to join. So welcome. We're going to have a little refreshment like we usually do. I prefer to have at this time of night a little cannabis and a little cognac. It's a nice before bed kind of little thing that just chills you out, gets you in the mood. You are free to have whatever you like. If you want a hot dog and a bag of Cheetos, hey, I don't judge. But I'm going to have a little Hennessy, the official cognac of Black people, because I am officially a Black people. And we're just going to have a little that much. Because you don't really need a lot. And this is pretty much my only drink of the week. And so I look forward to it. I try to savor it. And so we have just about that much, which I probably will not finish. But I'm going to start. Here's to you. Oh, yeah, that's nice. And for our cognac, I'm already blitzed. I don't even know the difference between cognac and cannabis. For our cannabis, we have a provisions cart. It's a Jack Herrera. And this is a church battery. And so we do it like this. I saw one of the young people online talking about how, and they were kind of a little bit outraged, you know, how come all I see is old people smoking weed online? And all the old people were like, because we've been smoking weed, that's how you got here. Shut up, child. So anyway, now that we have that out of the way, I mellowed out, and now I have an excuse for when I can't remember stuff in the middle of a sentence. It's not because I'm senile. It's because I'm stoned. Shh, let's go with that. This is the point of the show, the start of the show, where I get to rant. And, one of the things I like to talk about is stereotypes. I like to talk about current events and how they kind of come together. And this is my comediosophy segment, where a comedian gives her philosophy on what's going on. Now, the whole news, there's a couple of things in the news now. Of course, is the murder of Charlie Kirk and the Epstein files, which may or may not be more related than we know. But the thing that's happened with the murder of Charlie Kirk is he has been martyred. And that's hard for some people to understand. It also serves to to quiet and vilify any dissent. You can't speak about him because he is a hero to us, and he means a lot to us. And so you can't make any negative comments, whether they're warranted or not. And this is a tradition in this country that goes back to the beginning of the country. And it's what I like to call the most dangerous stereotype in America. We think of stereotypes as things, stories that put people down, you know, women are stupid, Black people are stupid, you know. And we think about the stereotype of the stupid mammy and the stupid bumbling housewife and all of these stereotypes. So we don't think about none of those stereotypes serve any purpose unless you have a hero stereotype. And in this country, that is the strong jawed white man savior and hero. This is the most dangerous stereotype we have. And generations upon generations upon generations of men of all races have been raised to glorify and to accept this standard of masculinity as the epitome of what you're supposed to aspire to. And it's usually the image throughout history has always been kind of like a soft-spoken killer. If you watch action movies, or if you go to the movies nowadays and you see the coming attractions, they all have this stereotype, this unassuming, handsome, young, blonde man who finds himself in some kind of trouble where he doesn't want to, but he has to kill a bunch of people in order to save the dog or something like that. And this hero has been built up and given permission by the other myth, the myth of white Jesus, of God as a white man. And so you have these double forces working that indoctrinate us all into believing that all our problems can be solved with the right white man in charge. Or doesn't have to be the right one, could be anyone, which is how we got Donald Trump. He, as much as was elected, was cast as president. He has no experience as president. His experience is as a spokesmodel and, you know, just a front man for a bunch of brands. And so as president, that seems to be his role. He's like the mascot of Project 2025. It doesn't seem like it's this blueprint is supposed to work. If it's working, it's fucking everything up. That seems to be the whole ball of wax. But it makes me think about, as somebody who grew up with the civil rights movement, it makes me wonder, how did we get to this point where this image of the hero white man prevails? I mean, it's a progression. It doesn't just come up out of nowhere. But there were certain things at play back then that seemed not to be so important now. Back in the 50s and 60s, all we saw in the news when you talked about white power and white supremacy, you talked about WASP. They talked about WASP, and you were supposed to be a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, or you were not fully American either. You were better off than a Black person or a Hispanic person or a Native American, but you were more like white adjacent. In fact, a couple of years ago, I used to do a series called White People, We Need to Talk. And I did a little video about that. Take a look.
Hi, welcome back to White People, We Need to Talk. Today's episode is The Caucasity of Whiteness. When did all these people officially become white who were never white before? When I was a little girl in the 50s and 60s, white people were WASPs. Everybody else was white adjacent, and they were always referred to collectively. The Irish, the Italians, the Polish, etc. You know, like Archie Bunker would do when he was being polite.
But now I'm seeing all these formerly adjacent white people claiming full caucasity, with all its benefits and perks, while hollering that they don't understand privilege. So, when did you become white? And why? So, when did you become white? When did ethnicities, different ethnicities, get swept up into the white power structure that was once just the, you know, what do you call it? Preview, purview of WASP. And where did the WASP go? And it makes you wonder about, you know, shadow governments and all kind of stuff. But there's something, you know, there's a producer of this reality show we're living. Because this ain't real life. This I said last week. This should be funny. We should be able, if we wrote this as a script, all the writers would sit around the table and crack up. And then when they tried to sell it, people, and ain't nobody gonna believe that. And you get kicked out of the office because it's so absurd. But what prevails is this image that so many want to believe and that had been taken from them. You know, this image of the white male savior. And so this generation of young men feels cheated. They're not going to inherit that gung-ho image. They're going to be seen as one of the guys, one of the folks, just like Jose and Dante. That's jarring. Joanne Reed asked the question, why are y'all so mad? I'll play a little bit of that. Not too much, but we'll put a link to it so you can visit it later. But why are y'all so mad?
Why are y'all so angry? You have the White House. You have both houses of Congress. You have a Supreme Court that is completely obedient to your president. They're willing to give him unlimited power. They're willing to say that he can take SEAL Team 6 and kill anybody he wants. They were willing to affirm that. They're willing to say that ICE can racially profile anybody they want. The United States Supreme Court has said you can racially profile Latinos based on their accent or the way they look. You guys have everything you want. You have legal racial profiling. You've ended DEI. You've ended affirmative action. You get all the best jobs, even if you're not qualified. You can be a Fox Weekend host and be the Defense Department's Secretary of Defense. You can be Cash Patel and be a podcaster who wants to go to Valhalla and run the FBI, as long as you're conservative. You have everything. Why are y'all so angry? What the fuck are you angry about? You've banned all of our books. You've banned Black history. You banned the 1619 Project. You don't have to compete with women for jobs. You've chased them out of the military. You've chased them out of the senior positions in the Department of Defense. You've gotten rid of all the Black history in the museums. The people who are working for the federal government are afraid to say the word Black. You guys have canceled Black scholarships. You're damn near, I guess, ready to get rid of HBCUs. Donald Trump just recently said they're not going to fund any minority-serving institution. Y'all have gotten rid of that. You've gotten rid of help for Black kids to go to college. What more do you want? What are you so angry about? And I think I have a suspicion and I have a guess. What you all are angry about is that while you have gotten everything you wanted on the right, we on the other side won't give you love for it. We won't respect you for it. We won't hail you for it. We won't respect you and say, hey, we want to, you know, have you at the Oscars. We want to fet you. We want to make you guys. We want to wrap our arms around you. You want us to embrace you. You don't just want to run us and tell us what to do and tell us what to think and tell us what to read and tell us what history we can have. You don't just want to tell us what to do. You want us to embrace you. What you really want is to sit at our table. You're mad because while you are running the country into the ground, you're destroying your own farmers with tariffs. You're destroying your own farmers by taking away their subsidies that used to go with USAID. You got what you wanted. They've ended the farm subsidies. These are the things y'all asked for. You got your big, beautiful budget. That's what you wanted. Trump gave it right to you. You got your permanent tax cut. You're still pissed because the left, the other side, the majority, we still cannot stand you. We cannot stand Christian nationalism. We don't want it. And because we will not say we want your Christian nationalism, we embrace your Christian nationalism, we like your Christian nationalism, we like you. Because we won't do that, that's why you're still mad. But guess what we're going to keep on doing? We're going to keep on being moisturized and unbothered, and we're still not going to like it.
So you have this thing where Black people now are being goaded into conflict that we really don't want and never really wanted. When things are so oppressive, We've always rebelled and tried to get the foot off our neck, but nobody is looking to take over nothing. They would just be left alone. That's all people really want. But we're being goaded through the media by way of the Republican Party and MAGA and all of those, putting out this whole thing. You didn't say you love Charlie Kirk, so you hate America. And this is a liberal war. We've been at war, and we just to say America at large, well, blue America, has been at war since Donald Trump was elected. The first time he declared war on half the country, or more than half the country, from day one. And the election between him and Kamala Harris was pretty much Armageddon. It was a choice between good and evil, between mommy and daddy, between right and wrong. And America chose daddy and the image that they assumed all white men embody, which is silly. Of course, nobody does. There's nobody, you know, whether you're talking to founding fathers who, yeah, you build them up and all that stuff. But they were basically a bunch of guys who got together in bars and plotted how to not pay taxes. They were slave owners. They were fighting over who got to keep their slaves. I mean, we have made heroes out of people who seceded from the country, started their own country, and declared war. And yet those are heroes where they're, you know, restoring their statues and stuff that, you know, people who want a more equal, woke America has said, come on now, if we're going to all get together, you got to take that down. This is, you can't have make a hero out of that. No, they have to be. I mean, that's what unites America for them. And nobody is really, you know, they talk about division and divisive and stuff. How are you going to call black people divisive when you divided us from when we got here? We've been divided since day one. We're the ones talking about inclusion. We're the ones who are talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it's not us who are saying no to that. So to blame black people for crime when you got a felon in the White House, hello, who is under investigation for being a pedophile. And if not being one, hanging out with one. Gary Hart had a date on a boat and he got kicked out of the primaries. He couldn't run for president. Donald Trump has been conclusively in the media linked with two convicted pedophiles. He's still white man hero. And really, he is being lionized through the social media to be not just John Wayne, but Jesus. How are you going to have a picture of Donald Trump as John, or with John Wayne and Jesus? And why are those the two images that exemplify what it is to be a man? And so now that kind of thinking is being transferred to Charlie Kirk. He has become Jesus's most welcome new guest. And of course, there are videos of him and Donald Trump and, and Jesus all palling around, you know, we white saviors have to stick together kind of thing. And the right has gone out of its way to include him, equity, you know, made him and Martin Luther King the same. And Bernice King, Reverend Bernice King, posted a meme that had her and other assassinated American men in a group, had Dr. King. But I've seen just, you know, Charlie Kirk and Martin Luther King, equal martyrs for each side. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time trying to debunk something so obviously untrue to anybody who's awake. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. But to be aware of how these images and these emotions are manufactured, not just in this instance, but in many instances, they're being manufactured and they're being put out into the collective consciousness in a way that makes true and false and right and wrong meaningless. Because once you have connected the president with Jesus and John Wayne, there is no right and wrong. There is only him and what he says. So we have to be careful about how we talk about things and how we try to have equity for me, but not thee. You know, you can't really do that. And this, whether it is the last gasp of Watts or the last gasp of John Wayne, this whole notion that you can have an equal and equitable society with only one group in charge and nobody else has any say, and that you can influence them and basically automate them to do your bidding. This is a very dangerous thing that people in my industry inadvertently help. We've always been and often find ourselves participating in things that make us the propaganda arm of white supremacy. And we have to fight that, not just as Black people or people of color, but as women too, because women are used to uphold this invincible theory of masculinity and to downplay their own goddessness in being the creators of these human beings. And so you have these situations for all of us where we are put down and blamed at the same time. We're blamed for being worthy of being put down when this system has been created that way in order to uphold this concept of whiteness and whiteness as rightness. Be aware, you know? And one of the most powerful things you can do is say, fuck all that. Because first you have to buy into it for it to ever be effective. No, fuck all that. Because with that mindset, then you try to find ways to correct things. And you try to find ways to do things differently. If you accept this is true, then you just tend to give up. But these right now the waters are being tested to people are trying to see, did they buy it? Are they buying it? And a lot of people are, but a lot of people ain't. And we have to start talking to them. We have to start talking to them and not about them and not having our image of them shaped by what other people say. And one woman that I know personally decided that the story they were telling about women of a certain age was bullshit, and she was going to do something about it. So she did. She created women, funny women of a certain age, fucking machine that tours and has table shows and it's just become its own. It's more than just a project because it gives women of a certain age a platform and just a chance to do what we do in a way that's never been done. We're going to talk about that with her right now. If she's ready to come out, please welcome my guest, Carol Montgomery.
Hey!
Honey, how are you?
I am good. I was listening to you. I was like, yeah, I kept shaking my head. Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah, you know, but, you know, we all know it, but nobody talks about it. So we think we're crazy and file those thoughts in the back way and don't let them come, you know, to the forefront of our mind and get to, what do you think this? You have to be willing to consider these things and to talk mm-hmm. about them and not just feel mm-hmm. shamed. Yeah. And stay in your place.
Well, I was just going to say, I know a lot of people that are, all of this bullshit is around us and they're just living their lives and not really, they're just going on as if everything's okay. And it's just like, because I really do think that people are like, well, you know, I'm okay. Like, you know what I mean? Like they're like, I'm okay. So and my friends are okay, so they don't really want to go further than that.
They come back and say, oh, I just got laid off, or oh, I right. can't find anybody to pick my strawberries. Now, right. you know, that's just a terrible thing that they think landed from outer space. But no, you've been You contributed to that. You made that happen.
We've been telling you. Yes.
But now let's take it back. Mm-hmm. Let's take it back.
Yes.
As a little girl, okay? How were you raised to see yourself as a female in this society? What was your role and the goal you were told you were supposed to follow?
Wow. Okay. I was, you know, that's so interesting. Wow. Couple of things. I have a solo show that I wrote called I Am My Father's Son. And it's all about the fact that up until basically when I grew tits is that I realized, I'm not a boy. Do you know what I just, because my, I was a very, I think that if I was growing up now, about 12 years old, I would have been a they. Because I'm still not very girly, but I was not a girl, but I was not a boy. And I liked to climb and I liked to do this. And then tits came and I was like, what's this? You know, so there was do you know what I mean? Like it became this whole, I didn't know what I wanted, what I was supposed to be. And then when my parents wanted me to get married and have children and have a man take care of me, which my sister did. And she has, you know, good life. You know, I'm not putting her down. Well, I married a man that was a musician, you know, and like I say in my act, so I'll be working the rest of my fucking. They couldn't understand, like, you need to have a man to take care of you. And I was like, I want to be a comedian. And so I found a man that would, not that he would accept it, but he's my partner. So of course he was like, you're a comedian, I'm a musician, we're going to do this. So we never had that normal 9-to-5 job or all that stuff. So I, you know, and as a woman, I don't understand when people tell me I shouldn't do things because I'm a female. Do you know what I mean? Like when I started as a comic, that was the big, because back then I was considered blue. Now I'm considered probably G, but back then and they would say, you're a woman, you shouldn't talk about sex, or you're a mom, you shouldn't talk about this. And I never understood that whole, I was just like, I'm just a human being. I've never understood why my gender meant so much to so many people.
Well, what year did you start doing stand-up?
I started doing stand-up in 79.
Okay, so you came through the Vietnam hippie whole Woodstock Beatlemania thing.
Right.
All of those things. And it was very gendered back then. You had the happy housewife, the pearls and heels, and darling, your dinner will be ready as soon as I finish ironing your shirt kind of thing was... You know, if we even think about show business, they're leading men, and then they're you know, his what do you call him? Not leading lady, but she's a second. She's always second. She's not the star. No. And so we were supposed to be secretaries. There weren't even a whole lot of options. I was a switchboard operator, or some women went into court reporting or being a secretary or a seamstress or something. There weren't many opportunities. What made you say, I'm going to do stand-up?
I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be in show business. So I went to college for 6 months. I went to Brooklyn College and I took an acting class at Brooklyn College. And I remember the teacher saying, who wants to do this for a living? And I was the only student that raised my hand. Everybody else was just taking it for the credit. So I thought, and I still feel this way. I'm going to learn. I'm going to get my lessons from life. So I started to do I was doing a lot of techie work, you know, lights and, painting sets and stage managing. And so I ended up doing summer stock in 79. And I was with a bunch of other tech people. And I guess I don't really remember this now, but I must have been very, the way we are when we banter. And one of my friends said to me, you should be a comedian. And I was like, huh? Like, because, people who are watching this, they don't understand that back in the, 70s, and you started earlier than I did, there was really not a lot of comedians. Right. And so my friend and I sat down and wrote 5 minutes, and we had a we were doing a Christmas party in July, and I got on stage and I did my 5 minutes, and I guess I did well. I don't remember what it was. And I was hooked. I came home from Summerstock. I took the bus because I lived in Brooklyn with my parents. I took the bus up Ocean Avenue, and I got let off at Pips in Sheepshead Bay. And that's where I did my first spot.
Okay. All right. Well, so from 79, because I remember 79 very well. Well, I don't remember a lot of it. There was a lot of things to get into back then. Did you ever fall into the traps?
Not really. You know, I was very, like, I'm the type of person in general that, like, when I'm focused, that's it. And all I wanted to do, once I realized what comedy was, that's all I ever wanted to do. I mean, like, I studied it. I would watch late night comics, and I would tape them on my Beta tapes and watch them. You know what I mean? Like, I so wanted to do this. So I didn't really, you know, I was never a big drinker. I mean, my husband and I both dabbled in pot and, you know, weed and some coke, but nothing. You know what I liked? Okay, I'll tell you what I liked.
All right.
And in the early 80s, there was Quaaludes.
Yeah.
Love.
Yeah. I'm somewhat familiar with that.
Somewhat, just a little bit. Yeah.
Like Roarer 714.
Mm-hmm. I love Quaaludes. But I never really fell into the traps. I mean, I didn't hang out a lot because the guys used to give me shit. They go, "You're not a real comedian because you're not hanging out at the clubs." I said, "I want to talk about what I do in my life, and if I don't have a life to live, then what am I talking about? Hanging out with you guys drinking? I mean, that's how do you make that fun?"
Yeah. Well, before we go any further, kids, if you're watching, go to bed. Second, don't do Quaaludes. Don't do that. Yeah. First of all, you can't find them, but they're not really something you should think about aspiring to ever, just so I can be responsible as a granny figure. So now, you said, though, something interesting. You said you were your father's son.
Yes.
So you and he were close, but he saw you like a tomboy.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So you were given duties like a boy. Not just girly things.
Well, I never did girly things. Do you know what? Like, I just wasn't a girl. I've always been very loud and obnoxious, and that's my father. My father would walk into a room, and it could be 1,000 people, and everyone stopped because he was that much of a presence. But I mean, like, I remember being a little girl, and he used to shave in the morning because he was a teacher. So I would watch him shave. And one day I picked up the shaving cream and I used a toothbrush and we shaved along together. So he never said, like I said, "You shouldn't do that because you're a girl," until, you know, tits came and then he didn't know what to do.
Yeah, that started early, though, with me. When I was about 6, they made me put a shirt on. I was outraged. Outraged. Why do I have to put a shirt on to go outside? It's hot outside. This made no sense to me. I don't have tits. I'm 6.
Yep.
But anyway, I was thinking, though, when you're hanging out with the guys and you grow up like that, did that kind of masculine energy, for lack of a better word, help when you decided, "I'm going to do something about this. I can't get booked because I'm old shit"?
Probably. I mean, I've always been somebody that if somebody tells me I can't do something, I'm like, "Watch me." Like I never understood, "You shouldn't do that," especially if you shouldn't do it or you can't do it. I've always basically just gone, "Well, yeah, now I have to do it." You know, like if somebody said, "You shouldn't jump out the window," I'd be like, "Oh, now I have to jump."
No.
You know what I mean? Like, I have to prove that they're wrong and I'm right. And the way I came about with Funny Women of a Certain Age, and absolutely what you said, it was, I wasn't getting booked anymore. You know, when I was in Vegas, I was in Crazy Girls for 10 years. Oh, 10 years, Crazy Girls and Midnight Fantasy. And when I came back to New York, it was like the entire world to change. The internet had just started. And all of a sudden I was like, wait a minute. I used to be on the road. I was on the road 3 weeks every month. I took my son with me when he was 6 weeks old back on the road. And all of a sudden I was not doing it. And I was like, what's different? Oh, I'm older.
See, that's not, I wasn't meant to be a knock on you in any kind of way, because that's the playbook we all, you know, that we all had to get smacked with that reality. So when in between that, you said you did the, you were in Vegas for 10 years.
Yep.
How'd you get into that? And was that something you thought was good to do? Because those kind of things can get to be a rut after a while and don't really challenge you. Did you feel stymied?
Oh, yeah. Well, what happened was, it's so funny when I think about these stories, because when you tell them, you're like, come on, that didn't happen. So back in the day, when the Riviera was still open, they used to have the Riviera Comedy Club. Mm-hmm. And the Riviera Comedy Club was run by a guy named Steve Sciarippa, who everyone knows, you know, he was on Blue Bloods. He was Bobby Bacala on The Sopranos. And we went to high school together. So I was working at the club, and the woman who was the comic in Crazy Girls right next door had gotten sick. She had a heart attack. And Steve said, listen, I need you to cover for her. And I said, sure, not a problem. I did 27 shows that week. I would go to the comedy club. I would do my spot, go over to Crazy, and go back and forth and back and forth. And then at the end of the week, it turned out that they were not going to renew that person's contract. So they said, do you want to come and, you know, live in Vegas for a year and we'll sign you to a contract? And I went, yeah. I said, the only thing was, is I had to bring my son. My son was 4 then. Okay. As time wise, my son's 33 now. So he was 4. And so I was like, this will be great. I won't have to go on the road. You know, I can take him, you know, like, to me, it was the perfect, perfect job. And I would still be there. Do you know, had they not tore down the Riviera. I mean, I loved it. I thought I loved, you know, okay. The thing about it being redundant in the set, you do not grow. I will absolutely agree with you. You do not grow at all, because you're, especially when you're doing a burlesque show, which you're doing the 10 minutes. Hey. And it's the same 10 minutes. And when you don't do, you know what I mean? Like, so you don't grow. I will tell you a very funny story though, that, so I had my 10 minutes down and I used to end on a joke. And I just wanted to fuck with the girls one day. And just so, because they would hear that ending, the setup, and they'd start to get ready. So I opened with my last joke. And it was like hearing a herd of cows coming, running up the stairs, going, she's getting off, she's getting off. And then they realized what I did, and they all stood behind the curtain going,
we're going to get you.
We're going to get you up.
Didn't they?
Yeah, they. They were, it was, I loved it. I laughed my ass off.
So now the first time you say, I'm going to do this show, how'd you go about putting together, did the special come first or the actual tour or the actual?
The live show came first. Okay. I was doing a podcast with a bunch of other older women. And at the end of the podcast, I remember calling my husband and saying, I think I have an idea, because we were having the best time. It's like what you and I are doing now, just talking and bullshitting. Older women have things to say, you know, and it you know, and there's no fear about saying it anymore, because we just don't give a shit.
Hey,
exactly. Cheers. So, you know, I what's so fascinating, like when I think back on how it happened, the timeline, it's quite interesting, because it's like I came up with the idea and I was talking to another friend of mine who was running a comedy festival, and she said, you know, why don't you premiere the show at my festival? I said, okay, great. We had Judy Gold, we had Janine Garofalo, we had Rhonda Hanson, we had a nice crowd. It was sold out, and there was a woman in the audience who said, I work at this theater called The Crane, and I think my boss will love this show. So that's how that happened. And that turned into a 6-year monthly residence. And from there is where we did the showcase for all the networks. And I wanted to go with Showtime, because they gave me my first TV spot, my first big TV spot. Because do you remember the Showtime Comedy Club that they used to have?
Yeah, but I was doing Evening at the Improv, I think.
Right. You couldn't do both. Right. So I ended up doing the Showtime Comedy Club Network. And then out of that came the show. Like, I guess I was on the All-Stars 1 year. And I wanted to go back to Showtime because I felt like, well, you guys gave me my first one. And that's basically how it happened is, they love the kid. And it's so funny because he's probably in his 40s, but to me, he's a kid. The kid that greenlit the project totally got it. Like when we pitched it to him, there was no like, hand it. And he was like, no, I get it. And he was the one that pushed everything through.
So it's interesting, without revealing your age, if you don't want to, there's a movement that started on TikTok called the We Do Not Care Club.
Yes, I saw that.
You've seen it. And these are women who are menopausal. And so we do not care. And it just took off. I remember the first woman, she was laying in bed with her bonnet going, we do not care. We do not care. And women just flocked.
So I started this club called a We Do Not Care Club. And this is for anybody going through perimenopause and menopause. I posted a video asking who wanted to join. And when I tell you we got so many members in this club, well, what I did was compile a list of all the stuff that we don't care about no more. Okay? We don't care about bras no more because bras suffocate us. We don't need that no more. We don't care if we look pregnant and we're really not pregnant. We don't care about matching clothes and wearing PJs all day. Clothes is clothes. That's it. That's the standard. And then lastly, we don't care about going in public because it's too peoply outside. It's too many people out there. It's too many people. It's too much noise. Okay? So comment down below and let's keep this going and let's keep sharing what we don't care about. Okay? And welcome to the club for all the new members. Welcome.
Was this kind of something that happened after menopause? That was there a correlation there?
I don't, well, maybe. I mean, like, I don't, the whole menopause movement has really grown, which I think is great because I didn't know anything, you know. You know, when I went through menopause, I was like, I'm really hot. You know? There was no creams, there was no hormones. So I didn't even think about that part of being a woman. I was just like, I came up with the show. I'm 67 now. I came up with the show when I was 15. Okay. And I knew, because I just knew what was coming. I could feel it already. It was like, wait a minute. Like, even when I go into the club, I would go into the clubs, you'd hear, what's that old bitch?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, well, now you have to help me up on this stage.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Shut up, you little shit. Anyway, so how have young people embraced this show?
I think so. I really do. I mean, the first two specials were shot here in New York at the Bell House in Brooklyn. And then we shot ours, the show that you did, which, of course, for the people who don't know, Marsha did an amazing job.
You know, it's going viral. It's gone viral. It's all over. I think we got some the clips from 4, 5, 6 different accounts.
They're just
all over my timeline.
Yeah, it's just the one that, especially for yours is about to hit 1.7 million.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was women you get to know, women you know, but you know, what made you get Terry Hatcher?
Because
it worked.
Oh, I know she worked really well.
She was wonderful, but so like, the hell is she doing here? It was like, how did that come together?
When we pitched the show, so the original show was always supposed to help women who hadn't been known, because as you know in the business, there's so many women that are great comics that nobody knows about, and okay, just making a living. I mean, we make livings, but it was more about putting this, you know, the spotlight on it.
Right.
So my producing partner said, you know, in the pitch, the first original pitch, we were like, oh yeah, and we'll get, you know, Ellen DeGeneres and, you know, and Roseanne and all these people. And of course, none of them would do it because, you know, and so we got, and that's when we got Fran Drescher. And Showtime was like, we want an actress who's funny. Okay.
Yeah. Well, she had done Night Court. I knew she was funny. But she was very young when she did Night Court. But I knew she was, but to do a stand-up, that was surprising. Somebody else is coming up that's surprising. It's Tisha Campbell.
Yeah.
Tisha is doing wonderful. I mean, you know, and you knew she was funny as an actress.
Right.
But to actually stand on stage and do stand-up is a whole different kettle of fish. That takes an intestinal fortitude that, you know, people who are used to working with other people and having props and things to rely on.
Right.
When you're naked on stage with a mic, that's a whole different thing. And so it's really impressive to see newbies, people who've never done it, just step up to the plate and go move. You know,
and Terry really, I was really proud of her. We worked a little bit. I helped her, you know, just because I've always said that you can, if you have the confidence level and not the material, you can get away with it. Because it's a matter, if you show fear, just like dogs, if you show fear in the audience, they'll hate you. But if you go on stage and just don't give a shit.
Yeah. Well, trust yourself, you know, and that takes, to do it consistently takes decades to learn to trust yourself. Because somehow we get away from the reality that the ability to make people laugh is what got you in here. You didn't get that as you work. You had that all along. Just trust that, yes, you're going to make people laugh.
Right.
Then you can go about the business of you know, making a living. But it takes so long to get back to that circle that says, you know, this is who I am. This is what I do. Oh, it's not that daunting anymore.
Right. But well, I've said that, and I know this sounds really vain, but after 41 years of doing stand-up, if I have a bad show, chances are it's the audience.
Well, as a woman, it's always the audience. I don't care how many times I've been, when I started, it was your fault. Now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So what's the future look like for funny women of a certain age?
Well, we're still touring, you know. I love working with you when we did that theater in Ohio. That was so great.
I love to do it.
I
need to do more stand-up. I am at that point where, you know, we know who she is. Golden Girls kind of put you in that box from just the 80s thing to where the stand-up, you know, the right. Kids. I'm in the, she's still live stage. That's yes, I'm still here. I love the idea of doing, working with you. I'd love working with you. It was a great show. It was a great,
that
was a great club too. And
you know, because I don't ever want to insult you. So when I get the gigs where the money is good, then I call you. Because the thing about our business is I know what everyone makes because I've been doing this a long time. But you can't call somebody and say, hey, listen, we can get some baked potato skins and maybe some mozzarella sticks and I'll get you cab fare. And it's like, nope. That's not the way we work, you know.
Well, I'll bring chili. I'm a pretty good cook. I can bring a pot. Don't worry about it. But we'll get something together. But
absolutely. Right now, yes.
I mean, I would love to, and I congratulate you on the success Funny Women of a Certain Age. Where can we see it right now? I know it's online, but where can we see it? Tell the audience to go.
Well, we re-released the specials in March, and that's where you're seeing all those clips. So they're cutting up all the clips, and that's why we're getting to see a lot more. But you can see it like on all the streaming networks, Amazon, Apple TV. You know, I'm sure there's some streaming thing I'm not remembering. I'm hoping
Bob's TV probably.
Huh?
Bob's TV.
Yeah, Bob's TV. Yes.
We do this from my house.
But I'm hoping I'm pushing my dream right now is because you know, Showtime was bought out by Paramount. So they're not doing any more comedy. And so my dream is to remake the show into like an evening at the Improv, where it's me as the host. And then I bring comics on and do time. That's what I would love to do. So we're hoping that we can do that. I'm hoping to somewhere somebody will hear me and go, oh, we should do that. And also we want to come to Vegas.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Now I'm going to say this, and maybe and make sure that we get this copywritten. This is our idea, but funny women of a certain size, a certain demographic, you can take this
everywhere. In
a lot of different, you know.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the
women of a certain religion.
Oh yeah.
You know.
We have the hashtag funny never gets old, because it's the same thing. This and as much as, of course, it's always about supporting women, but you know, there are older guys too, you know. I mean, like it's really a movement about Well, you know how many? Well, I once had a guy, an older comic, say to me, he goes, "How come you're not doing funny men of a certain age?" I said, "Because Jim Gaffigan doesn't need my fucking help."
Okay. Because there are so many other places you can go to get that done.
Yeah.
Give me
a
break. I mean, I don't mean any, because I love my sons, I love my comedians, you know, but there are so many other opportunities for young men. In comedy. I mean, it's just not equitable in any way. So if we have somebody who is advocating, and not just advocating, but making opportunities for people who are never thought of otherwise, I say, let's have that. You know, let us keep that for
let
ourselves.
Let us have that, right?
You know, you guys go ahead and then make your little circle joke. Jerks and do your little dick jokes and we'll be fine. So I know people are going to be mad at me for saying that. But anyway, if you stick around for a minute, I want to introduce my son. My youngest son is AOL. I hope he's well. But my oldest son is here, and he does videos that express the way he feels. So he does these gay mansplaining videos. I want you to watch, and then we'll bring him. A gay mansplains everything.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Stephen Roberts, and it is time for some gay mansplaining. Today, we're going to talk about this little item. Oh, yes. The phone. A lot of you have them. A lot of them are not used correctly by you people, so we're gonna have a little bit of review. A lot of people think that this is used for making phone calls, and that couldn't be farther from the truth. That's not for making phone calls, it's for avoiding people. Yes, you're not talking voice to voice with people, are you? You shouldn't be. Texting is allowed, but you should always, always, always screen everything. Screen your phone calls, screen the texting, even screen sexting for some of you dirty birds out there. So that's what the phone is for. It's for keeping you as far away from people face to face, voice to voice as possible. Everybody knows this. Everybody knows this. It's also for things like getting likes on social media. Perfect. The more popular you are, the more people are going to want to call you, and the more you want to stay away from them. See, now you're getting it. Yeah, it's for hooking up with people, like on Grindr and Tinder, and a date if you must. And it's also figuring out what to wear. It's also about finding out what the big bad orange clown is doing, God forbid. But don't do that too much. You know, it's really bad for you. And then, of course, in the very long, broad view of it, it's for watching cats do things that are a lot of fun. That's what the phone is for. Cats playing piano, beating each other up, jumping over obstacles. And that's the phone. Good luck. Hope you improve your life with your phone.
Okay. Well, now we know how to talk to Steve on the phone. Let's bring him out and let him how to talk to him in person. Stephen Roberts.
Hello. It's not just me. Everybody should behave this way.
And leave it to the white guy to tell everybody how to behave. But anyway, do you know Carol?
I don't know Carol. Carol and I have just recently met, and it's really wonderful. It's wonderful to meet you, Carol.
It's wonderful to meet you too, Stephen.
That's Miss Carol to you.
Miss Carol.
Miss Janet, if you're nasty.
There you go.
And I'm nasty.
Yes, he is. What is, you have any questions? What do you think? As a,
you know, I have a question
approaching a certain age.
Yeah, I have a question for both of you to answer it each. So we know that Marsha has always been an activist of some sort since she started her career. And, you know, we know that Marsha refused to go into the belly room at the Comedy Store. And so my question to my mom, and also I want Carol's input on this as well, is if you see Women of a Certain Age show as the same kind of thing as the belly room, or are they different? And why are they different?
Well, that's
for me, the insult of the belly room was that we were being taken out of the inclusive room, the room that had men, women, people of different ethnicities. We were being separated and sent in the back upstairs in a room that wasn't finished and only sat 90 people. And it felt like a slap in the face, like you're not good enough for the original room. We're not even talking about the main room. We're talking about the original room. You're not good enough for the original room, so you have to go through the parking lot,
mm-hmm.
up the stairs to, and it was unfinished at that time. It was just, it just felt really like a slap in the face, especially coming from a woman.
Right.
That was Mitzi, and to treat women as the novelty acts, to novelty actize us even more so than we were at that time, you know. I just didn't feel that way. Whereas this is like another opportunity that, you know, there is that separate you out from everybody else element, but at least you're competing on the same level. You know, you're not being sent to Tubi. You're getting the same opportunity. It's almost, and I realize I'm justifying, because my natural first instinct is to always be inclusive, is to always be representative of.
Yeah, everybody. But your explanation of the comedy about being taken from a main room and put in a separate room makes sense. And
yeah, that was
part that I haven't considered, to be honest.
But I, like I said, even though it is on the same plane, on the same level, so it doesn't have that degree of insult, my druthers would be a show, even on my talk show, I wanted the audience to be to look like America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And Carol, we see now at clubs like Laugh Factory and other clubs where they have chocolate sundaes and they have different types of people show.
Left-handed typist night. And
Did you find yourself curating it in a particular way? Obviously, women of a certain age. I mean,
well,
that's the obvious part. But do you curate it in a particular way beyond that?
Well, I'm like Marsha was saying about being inclusive. I mean, I always make sure that, you know, I don't look at women. I look to see if they're old. Do you know what I mean? If they're old and they're funny, I want you on my show. But I do want to make sure that it's not just the white older women show. You know, I make sure people of color, LGBTQIA. I mean, I want everyone to be seen, because what I love about my show is that everyone is different. Like one of the biggest things, I don't know if you heard this when you were coming up, Marsha, but it's like women only talk about the same thing, you know? Yeah. And it's like, if you look at it, this is just, well, even the live show, but if you look at all three specials, there is not one woman. We may overlap on subject, but we're all different.
Sure.
We all have a point of view. Childbirth fucks up your shit. Do you know what I'm saying? It fucks everything. First of all, you know, young women, like when they hear about childbirth, they think it's beautiful and magical. And angels are singing. And unicorns are dead. You shit yourself, okay? Just so you... Anyway, my son was born 2 weeks late. Okay, typical man, he wanted to stay inside as long as he possibly could. And that little shit would not come out of me, okay? So I call my doctor, right? It was a Friday afternoon. I'll never forget this. I said, please, can I come in? Please induce me. He goes, Carol,
I'm golfing this weekend. I'll induce you on Monday. But over the weekend, try to induce your baby yourself. This is actually a medical procedure. It's called natural induction. You have to make love a lot, have nipple stimulation, and take a lot of long walks. My husband hears this, and he goes, so let me get this straight. I get to fuck you, play with your tits, and tell you to go take a hike? I could do that.
Point of view, and I really wanted to bring that out, that women, just because, you know, we're women doesn't mean we're talking about our period or whatever, you know?
Like, I mean, we don't hear dick joke after dick joke.
Right. Yeah, like you were saying about that jerk, you know, the guy's talking about jerking off. It's like, how many times do you have to hear that? Oh, you know, I'm jerking off in the basement. Woo!
How many times do I have to listen to "Would you suck a dick for $1 million?
That was something that I was thinking about how Wanda did with the LGBTQ show, the Outstanding,
right,
to represent a community, but the diversity within the community was obvious, you know, just because everybody falls under one certain umbrella doesn't mean they're all approaching life in the same way. And that was really clear in those two shows, in the live show and the one that aired on cable. So we, I think, have pretty much solved all the world's problems.
We are
well on our way to a better future.
Just put women in charge.
That's why we're here. The Church of Jesus, the Book of Martyrs, all of this is, Martyrverse is to promote the fact that we need women in charge. We need, not just civility, we need more, diplomacy. We need more decorum, we need more compassion, we need more. You know, we need more grabbing people by the face and going, do you know how special you are? And pinching cheeks. We need that. And
mothering.
We need mothering. And so I say it's time to mother the world.
Yeah. I mean, I have this thing now where when I'm walking down the street in New York, because, you know, in New York, everyone is just like, and that was before asshole became president. I will literally, like, I'll be on the subway and I'll see a woman and dress nicely, and they'll have their earplugs in, you know, and everything. And I tap them on the shoulder, and the look of their face is like this. And then they go, I love that dress. And their face goes from to, oh, wow, thank you so much.
Yeah.
And it takes nothing out of my time. I will talk to people on the subway. I once, you know, I mean, that's what you should be doing. Make people happy.
We should make it okay to be nice.
Yes.
Know? And we've lost that. We absolutely have. In this reality show, in all reality shows fueled by conflict and manufactured outrage. But we have to understand that, you know, those of us sitting here, we have different emotions, and sometimes we need to just share them. Just, hey, hi, person.
Hey, how's it going?
You know? Well, I've had a wonderful time talking to you tonight. I'm so glad you stayed up and stopped by.
Oh, my God, this was so much fun. Thank you, Marcia. Thank you, Stephen.
Anytime, you know, and like I said, anything. I got a gig, you know, we take a bus and then we have to walk a few miles, you know, but I'll bring the chips.
I wouldn't do that to you. Well, thank you, guys. I had a great time. This was worth staying up. I'm going to pass out as soon as we're done.
All right. Well, sleep well. Good night. Thank you.
Thank you so much again. You guys have a great night. I'm going to go to sleep with my little puppy.
All right. Good night.
Have a good sleep. Thank you.
That was fun.
That was fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
I mean, which guests have you had that weren't any fun? You're proving that you pick good people in your life.
Most people are good people.
Have you ever met somebody who kept getting the wrong partner or the wrong boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever? And I just look at them sometimes and go, your picker's broken. You need to do something about your picker.
Boo, it's you. They're not the wrong people.
It's you. Yes. If your picker's broken, maybe we need to go fix it.
I'm starting with the person in the mirror. What the fuck is wrong with me?
Yeah.
You know, but again, we're so structured because that's the only way for people who have an agenda to make that agenda work is mm-hmm. that you have people so busy and confused that they can't fucking think straight because the solutions are so obvious. The situations are obvious when you strip away the artificial layers that have been put on everything. You know, if you don't have a preconceived notion that old women are not attractive or funny, you don't need a funny women of a certain age show.
Right.
You know, you have to be taught. Like I said, there is no blackness without whiteness. And it just, as one gets elevated, one gets demonized until we start to believe those things.
And that's true with every group of people. That's true with every group of people. Look at gay men. Gay men are really invisible after the age of 35. It's like if you're not a twink or you're not a particular kind, even bears, if you get to the whole idea of bears was created in the adversity of having to be fit and gorgeous as a gay man or you didn't belong in the pride parade. And so along comes bears and say, I'm big and hairy and I'm attracted to other big and hairy guys. And then there's this other group of people who are attracted to us. So fuck y'all.
Yeah, but that's, you're talking though, the effect within the community.
Yes.
But in the larger society, you're immediately lesser than.
Oh, immediately.
Once you are even suspected of being LGBTQIA or whatever, or anything that's not a gung-ho, let's screw everybody kind of personality, you are lesser than.
Our sexual orientation is the butt of jokes, and it is the worst
thing. Don't say the butt of jokes.
It could be the worst thing you could ever be called. To emasculate men, to emasculate each other is, you know, the worst thing that you could actually do. It's worse than calling your mama things, you know? Yeah.
The worst thing you can be called if you're a man is a woman. Mm-hmm. Or a woman's body part.
Or womanly.
Or someone who, yes, who is will trade his masculinity for those traits.
But that's,
according to them.
That's the same for women too, though. I mean, it's like you throw like a girl.
Well,
you know?
I am a girl.
Yeah. You ever see that Dove commercial where they have the little girls on in front of the camera and they said, run like a girl. And these little girls start, you know, making fun of themselves. Like they're, and then they ask this other girl, run like a girl. And she just goes, and you go, oh my God. And what we've done, yeah, what we've
but
done.
But even if you do throw like a girl, what was the young lady's, the little league pitcher who was striking everybody out and she pitched underhand like softball.
Yeah.
But she was phenomenal.
Uh-huh.
And that was a few years. What, Monet something was her name?
I don't know.
I don't remember.
That's sports.
But, yeah. Like a guy, like a gay
like a guy.
Guy
doesn't know any. Well, I do know some sports like gymnastics and figure skating.
Yes, and I understand. I used to be a big boxing fan. But anyway, but yes, even if you do it like a girl, you know, you bowl like a girl, that doesn't mean you're bad at it.
Right.
It means that you have ways of doing things.
Right.
But and we don't think like that. As we know, we want people to watch our show, to understand that the Marshaverse is a big tent, and we have a variety of things going on here. You know, we don't just tell jokes. We don't just do politics. We don't just have interviews. We have all this kind of stuff. And we are introducing a new a new web series called Truth Hunter, Adventures of a Time Traveling Gym Team. And we're putting that together, and it's going to be coming to you as soon as we can. But dude, we're going to tease it a little bit, and maybe you'll get your interest peaked and want to tune in when we're done.
It's percolating right now.
Yes, we're in our third trimester as far as the birthing process of this idea. So
I really think they're going to love it, don't you? I really think they're going to like it.
Adventures of a Time Traveling Gym Teacher. And we got some little tricks and stuff for it. Also want to welcome everybody to, if you like R&B, blues, jazz, hip hop, funk, whatever, anything that's got a beat on the 2 and 4 and came out of the swamps of the Delta. We do a playlist every week of my kind of music. I call it auntie music for each show. So look for those. You know, if I could, I'd play them while we're talking. But since I can't, you can. You could just turn it down low and have a nice little soundtrack as you watch us and join us with a drink or whatever floats your boat. Skills, wherever you are, I know people can see you at Jimmy Kimmel's, your own show, Show Those Skills, and on Sunday and Monday nights with Lunell at her show. So if you missed him tonight, get here to Vegas and then go buy a ticket to see him where I just told you he's going to be. Steven,
yes.
Where are you going to be this week?
Well, I am very excited that on Friday the 26th at the Orleans, you can see me on Scoops Fest, the ice cream social podcast that's very popular right now. Okay. They have invited me for their 4th or 5th. I do it every year now. I'm kind of a tradition there. And so you can see me on the 26th in Las Vegas. And I don't have a whole lot coming, but I will tell you, in November, you can see me all over Puppetry of the Penis.
Okay.
I'm doing that show quite a bit in October and November. So keep your eyes out.
I haven't seen the whole show, but
Do you want to?
The parts I've seen were very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I
don't take out my willy. It's my white castle. It stays in the bag, you know.
How do you make your penis do those things?
You stretch it. There's 3 parts to it. There's the penis, there's the scrotum, and then there's the testicles, and you use them all for things like you can make a hamburger, but I couldn't make a slider if I tried to, you know.
You know, this is one of those things that went over my head because I went
like that. Yeah, but you also
want to know. Huh?
You did ask.
Yeah, I did, but I didn't really want to know.
Okay, fair enough.
All right. Anyway,
my response next time will be, you don't want to know.
Yeah, I don't want to know. But sometimes you have to know. So anyway, thank you so much for joining us. Remember, Black History Museums, all museums are under attack right now. Mm-hmm. So do whatever you can to support them and be sure to tell your stories. Your family's story is part of American history. Write it down. Well, put it in a, you could put a book out on Amazon on the weekend. So, I mean, tell your story. Add it to the melting pot, the gumbo that's America, and stop letting them pass off this mashed potato pablum kind of silly ass version of history, you know. And to that end, we were talking in the beginning about the myth of the cowboy hero, the cowboy savior, you know, Jesus as John Wayne, embodied by Donald Trump. Talk about fiction writing and creating a narrative. But real cowboys and real founders, you know, just because they didn't write the Declaration or whatever, Black people played a very big role in founding this country. And the myth of the American cowboy is just as much a part of ours as it is of yours and of the Mexican-American vaqueros who were prototypical cowboys. Well, in fact, it's said that white men who did the same jobs were called cowmen. The boy was to describe the Black rodeo or cowboys. And so there is a Black rodeo still working, still touring. And so just as a nice, let's leave here tonight with a look at the Black cowboys today. Take care. See you next time, Stephen. Skills, we love you. We miss you. Bye-bye. Giddy up. Yeehaw.
What if I told you one of the biggest rodeo circuits in America isn't in Texas or Oklahoma? It's run out of Phoenix, Arizona. It's called Black Rodeo USA. And since 2011, it's been giving black cowboys and cowgirls a stage that mainstream rodeos rarely offered. You'll see it all. Bull riding, calf roping, barrel racing, but with an energy you won't find anywhere else. Gospel, hip-hop, family, and cowboy culture all come together under one arena roof. Riders travel from across the country to prove that the legacy of the black cowboy is alive, modern, and unstoppable. Here's the twist. Most people don't even know this rodeo exists. Yet every year, thousands pack the stands in Phoenix to watch black riders take the spotlight that history and Hollywood tried to erase. So tell me, why isn't Black Rodeo USA as famous as the PBR or the NFR? And would you buy a ticket if it came to your city? Comment rodeo if you'd show up to see this history in motion. And follow for more stories of black cowboy culture today.
You know that the queen is back, she's back, she's back. She withstands the test of time. When it comes to strength, she comes to mind. But now she gets back up again and again. I'm talking about Marsha. Marsha. You know you got it, you know you got it. No one can tell a joke like that. Got you laying on the ground, cracking up on your back.